This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour, the week in review.
Welcome to our weekly review of the important news. I'm Joel Hilliker, and with me is our panel. Here in the studio, we have Jeremiah Jacques.
Great to be here.
And Andrew Miller.
Hello.
From our office in Britain, we have Richard Palmer.
Good afternoon.
And also from Britain, we have Warren Reinsch.
Hello.
We're going to start today in Russia, where the president made a stunning announcement of sweeping changes to his nation's constitution. For this story, we'll go to Jeremiah.
Yes, Russian President Vladimir Putin sent shockwaves around the world, really, on Wednesday when, in his State of the Union address, he said that he'll be making the most sweeping changes to Russia's constitution since the document was put into force back in 1993. And then, just after this bombshell announcement, the entire Russian cabinet, from Prime Minister Dmitry Medvedev right on down, announced their resignations. And those resignations were at Putin's request, and it's all designed to facilitate this overhaul of the Constitution. So those were some incredibly momentous developments, and many of the details of exactly how the Constitution and the Russian government will take shape are not yet known. But we can get a clear view of what Putin's underpinning goal is by considering the fact that during his 20 years at the helm of Russia, and even in the lead up to that, he's killed far too many of his own people, and he's misappropriated far too many billions of dollars worth of Russia's wealth to ever want to willingly relinquish power. It would be just too dangerous. So he would never let go of the effective power voluntarily. But the Constitution won't allow him to seek presidency again after his current term ends in 2024, because no one is allowed to have more than two terms in a row. So because of that, analysts have long expected Putin to find some way to kind of game the system, stay in a position of power.
As he did once before.
Exactly. Yes, we've already seen him successfully game the system once. That was in 2008, after he completed his first two consecutive terms. At that time, he handed the presidency over to Medvedev, which is kind of his subservient protege, a loyalist who he can trust. And then Putin himself stepped into the office of prime minister. During that time, though, Putin continued to operate as the true power of Russia, and Medvedev functioned as essentially a puppet. Also in 2008, the government extended the presidential term from 4 years to 6 years, effective upon the next election. So in 2012, Putin returned to the presidency with a newly extended 6-year term. And so his rule was official once again, and then he was reelected once again in 2018 for another 6-year term. So speculation has been rife ever since 2018, really, and perhaps even before then, that Putin would maybe repeat a rendition of that Medvedev shuffle, that castling move, or that he would just nix the constitutional limits entirely. The way Xi Jinping recently did in China. But the new package of proposed amendments does not include scrapping presidential term limits. Instead, the changes that Putin's making will actually reduce presidential power significantly. All those powers that Putin has labored so arduously to build up and, you know, just to amass over the years, he is now dissipating them in a few different directions. From now on, it won't be the president, but the prime minister who will have the authority to appoint cabinet members. From now on, it won't be the president, but parliament that will have the power to confirm or veto those appointments that the prime minister makes. So all of that used to be in the president's hands, and now it's being kind of spread out to intentionally weaken the president's office. And then another big change that Putin is making is that future presidents can now serve only two terms altogether. So no, it used to be two terms in a row, and then you could possibly leave into another office and then return for two more. But now it's two terms total. So even Medvedev, for example, were he to return to the presidency, he would only be eligible for one more term because he's already served one back in 2008.
So it prevents another Putin from coming along
exactly
in one swoop.
That's right. Yeah. So it's really remarkable how Putin is taking all these powers that he gradually built up over the last 20 years, and now he's intentionally weakening the presidential office so that he can be sure that, like you said, he's the only Putin. No one else can come along and kind of repeat what he did. No one will be able to, his successor would never have as much power as he does in the presidency.
So he makes these moves that handicap the presidency, and no one's looking at this and seeing a good faith effort to try to prevent a dictator from taking the kind of power that he has. Pretty much everyone is viewing this as a setup to some other way that he's going to be able to secure his power even further.
That's right. Yes, Putin actually said these are pro-democracy changes that I'm making. Mm. But all analysts recognize that he is preparing to step into a new office in 2024. This is not an actual exit strategy that he's preparing for. It's just a, the masquerade of democracy will go on, but the dictatorship is really the reality of the situation there.
So, well, it'll be interesting to see how this unfolds, because there have been people who've said, knowing that 2024 would be the end of his rule, that they're already kind of saying, well, he's a lame duck, that the era of Putin is waning. And I think the people who are saying this don't have a real high regard for just how canny and cagey this man really is. But after this move, it seems like that kind of speculation is probably going to quiet down, that essentially we're waiting for the other shoe to drop here.
I think that's exactly right. From what I can tell, most everyone understands that Putin is laying the groundwork for him to be the true ruler of Russia for life, essentially. Whether that's, there's some speculation that he's building up the office of prime minister so that he could occupy that office, and weakening the presidency so that the prime minister even becomes the true power in Russia. In some nations, the prime minister is already the more powerful office. Even more likely, I think, is that Putin's eye is on the head of state council post. In the past, this has been a largely ceremonial office. But during his address on Wednesday, Putin called for this office to be enshrined in the Constitution. So it'll be imbued with some new, as yet undisclosed, powers that will likely be vast. And there's a good chance that Putin is transforming that into a comfortable new seat of power for him to step right into. There's also speculation that we've mentioned on Trumpet Hour before that after 2024, Putin will become head of the Union State of Russia and Belarus, which he is presently working with the Belarusian leadership to bring online. So he has several options there, but in actual practice, whatever specific office he ends up taking will not really make that much difference. Putin's ruled Russia with an increasingly tight grip for this entire century. Mm-hmm. And whether he keeps the title of president, which doesn't look likely at all at this point, or takes that of prime minister, or takes that of chief of state council, or head of Russia-Belarus Union State, or something else, despite whatever the specifics and the formalities turn out to be, Putin will remain the true power over Russia, and he'll remain one of the world's foremost despots.
So Gerald Fleury has pointed to this man and made some very startling statements about him with regard to biblical prophecy. And what I think is interesting is he has made a couple of statements that suggest it's possible that Putin already fulfilled those, and that I think he's at least left the door open for someone else to actually come in some of his statements. I mean, he's definitely been very strong about Putin overall, but it seems like this really kind of shuts the door on any speculation that someone else might step in. We're looking at a man who's fulfilling a very specific role in prophecy, who's really taking the helm for good here.
Yes. Yeah, I think you make a great point there. Mr. Fleury, I've got a quote here from something he wrote in September of 2014 in the Philadelphia Trumpet. He says, "I strongly believe Vladimir Putin is going to lead the 200 million man army." That's a specific prophecy there in the book of Revelation about an end time army. But then a little later in that article, he does say it doesn't totally have to be Putin himself, but it seems like Mr. Fleury is leaning heavily toward the idea that it would be Putin himself.
Right.
But yeah, I think that in light of this new development, it's probably far more sure that it would be Putin himself.
So maybe you could just give a brief overview of that and direct people to where they can read more about it.
Really, the linchpin prophecy that Mr. Fleury has pointed to is in Ezekiel 38. If you look in verses 1 through 8, it's really giving a lot of details about that end-time army that's described in other parts of the Bible, Revelation 9:16 and 16:12. And in Ezekiel 38, verses 1 and 2, it talks about a prince of Rosh, Meshech, and Tubal. These are basically ancient names for different sections of Russia, and it shows that it will be one ruler ruling over the entire, you know, the entire landmass there, all the disparate peoples that make up the world's largest country by geographic size. And so based on that prophecy, Mr. Fleury has identified Mr. Putin as the Prince of Rosh, and he's given several really powerful episodes of the Key of David that put all this into context. He's written an entire booklet called The Prophesied Prince of Russia that lays it out with inescapable clarity.
Well, thank you for that. We also have the article that Jeremiah wrote called Tsar Putin, Russian President Lays Groundwork to Rule Russia for Life. You can find that at thetrumpet.com on the front page there. We appreciate that, Jeremiah. It is official. The U.S. House of Representatives has impeached President Donald Trump. This week, they turned the articles of impeachment over to the Senate, where the trial will be held. For this story, we'll turn to Andrew Miller.
After a good delay, the House is moving towards the next step of the impeachment process. As you said, Speaker of the House Nancy Pelosi actually signed the articles of impeachment on Wednesday. So that does finally open the door for the U.S. Senate to look at this. And Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer looks like he's going to start that process off after the weekend, after a long weekend, on Tuesday, with looking at subpoenaing some witnesses, possibly even including John Bolton. So that process is it's moving along, but this is interesting to watch the dynamics of this unfold. When she signed the articles, Nancy Pelosi made this statement that Trump did not uphold his office to protect the Constitution of the United States. Actions were taken by the president undermining national security and jeopardizing the integrity of our elections. So today we make history, delivering articles of impeachment against the Senate of the United States. And so it's interesting watch how she operates. We've covered this on this program before, that it seems like these days she's the only Democrat playing lip service to the United States Constitution.
Oh, right. The way that they're talking, like they are the ultimate defenders of the Constitution, it's just hard to stomach, given how strong their attack against that founding document has been.
Right, and if you look on the, I guess what's now considered the more radical wing of the Democratic Party, the Bernie Sanders wing, the Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez wing, there's definitely much more people willing to speak up and condemn the Constitution, to say that we're going to impeach Donald Trump at any cost. And then you watch Nancy Pelosi, and she's not, I mean, in her actions, she's tearing down the Constitution as much as that radical wing is. But in her words, she pays lip service to it, and has even seemed, some would say, reluctant, at least early on, to initiate these impeachment proceedings. A lot of political analysts say, it's like, well, she didn't really want to do it, but the radical wing, the Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez wing, forces her hand. But the managing editor of the Trumpet website, Brad McDonald, had an article go up on the website that we'll put in the show notes entitled Nancy Pelosi Fulfills Prophecy, really pointing out that this is, if you judge by actions, this is really a difference of strategy than it is a difference of goal. Mm-hmm. It's not that Nancy Pelosi does not want Donald Trump impeached and then the radicals and the squad forced her to do it. It's just knowing that she, if there's any chance of it happening at all, which looks like there isn't, you're going to have to use a strategy very similar to the one she's using of trying to convince the average, everyday American that Trump committed a crime and we need to get rid of him to uphold the Constitution, mm-hmm. Instead of taking the radical approach of calling for the teardown of the system and that Trump's a fascist and we need to get rid of him at all cost.
Right.
That's there's definitely millions of people in America who do believe that Trump's a fascist and needs to be removed at all costs, but definitely not enough to remove him from office.
Yeah, even though her language suggests otherwise, she's really not far from that point of view. We've been working on the upcoming edition of The Trumpet. This is the March 2020 edition of The Trumpet, and there's a major blockbuster article in there from our editor-in-chief talking about this, the legacy of the Obama administration. And I think it ties in with that article from Brad McDonald beautifully about Nancy Pelosi. He's going back and pointing to things that Gerald Flory was saying at the time that Nancy Pelosi took control of the House. I believe it was 2008, and just how or was it 2006? And how radical her views are. And it really is very much of a piece with Barack Obama and his promise to fundamentally transform America, and all of the steps that he has taken that have become obvious since Donald Trump was elected. We've gotten a real strong look at just how radical they are, how far they're willing to go to undermine the results of that election, to do anything that they can to take this man out at whatever cost. And total disregard for the Constitution, total disregard for the law. I think the legacy of the Obama administration is very much alive and at play in what we're seeing taking place between with the Democrats in the House of Representatives this week.
Right, and they even point out in the article by Mr. McDonald that he quotes Mr. Flurry when she. Nancy Pelosi came to power in 2006, saying that this is a landmark moment for America that changed American politics forever. Now, 2006, that's even a couple years before Barack Obama was elected.
Mm-hmm.
But with benefit of hindsight, you could almost identify 2006 as kind of the seam where the radical left really, really started getting hold of the Democratic Party, her kind of coming in that midterm election as kind of the vanguard that led to Barack Obama's election 2 years later. But yeah, then the politics now, because now, I mean, a lot of it might be a difference in tactics, but now a lot of political commentators are talking like Nancy Pelosi's a moderate in her own party. But even if that were true, she's the one that led the change that allowed all these even more radical people to come on the scene. Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez would have never been a U.S. Congresswoman if Nancy Pelosi wasn't elected.
Mm-hmm. Well, we kind of made the point, I guess, when these impeachment this case first went through the House that it does show a certain desperation on the part of Democrats that they're trying to do this, knowing that there is no way that this is going to actually get through the Senate, that they're not actually going to remove him from office. And I think it's just a matter of time before this unhinged strategy that we see begins to balloon out into even greater acts of desperation. We're going to talk a little bit more about that in the second half, but we will definitely watch to see what happens. I would imagine that the vitriol and the anger, the frustration on the part of the left in America is only going to grow here in the weeks ahead as we see this dealt with, I'm sure, in a pretty rapid fashion in the Senate, that they're going to dispatch this and then it's going to be over. The Democrats have done everything that they can to try to keep this in the headlines as long as possible. But at some point, it's going to be over. And then what do they do next? They don't have too many options available to them. But I would imagine that we're going to start to see the even more radical wing of the party take stronger measures to try to undermine the president than what we've seen to this point. Well, we definitely will put that article from Brad McDonald in the show notes. Nancy Pelosi Fulfills Prophecy, an excellent article pointing back to that article from 2006 by Gerald Flurry. Go check that out at thetrumpet.com. Thank you for that, Andrew. The unfolding saga over Prince Harry and his wife's exit from the royal family has many people accusing the royals of racism. Meanwhile, a truly horrifying story about the actual effects of these kinds of accusations has been unfolding in Britain. We need to talk about race, and for this, we'll go to our man in Britain, Richard Palmer.
Yes, and we talked about the fallout from Mexit, as it's been known, Meghan and Harry announcing they're leaving the United Kingdom last week. But this week, I think what we've seen could really be a turning point for race relations in the UK. I think there has definitely been a mirror of what's been going on in the United States, in the UK, with universities talking about microaggressions and being ultra sensitive on race and getting rid of any speakers that are at all controversial. But I think the trend has not been as bad in the UK as it has been in the United States, this trend of deteriorating race relations and accusations of racism flying around. But it got a whole lot worse this week. There was really just a full court press from people on the left in the wake of Mexit to come out and say Britain is a racist society. Meghan Markle has left because Britain is fundamentally racist. The press is raceless. The establishment is racist. I mean, we talked about the New York Times last week, but they've been out there on just about all of the TV shows. They were out there doing all the morning shows this week. They were on Question Time last night, just talking about how Britain is a fundamentally racist society. I've never seen so many people saying this with such blanketed mainstream coverage as we have seen this week. Normally it's coming from one or two pretty fringe voices. Maybe they write an article that gets a lot of attention because of how ridiculous it is. But this kind of wall-to-wall coverage of Britain as a racist society, I have never seen before. It's been a dramatic escalation in this. And like you said, at exactly the same time, we've had a story on that exposes the terrible consequences of race baiting, that these kind of false accusations of racism have very real consequences. And these people that are on TV, they have no evidence. There's several videos where they'll talk about how racist it is. The host will ask, well, can you give us some examples? And they basically shoot back with, well, if you have to ask for proof, then you're racist.
Mm-hmm.
Just even asking for any proof of these really strong, that's a big claim. Society is fundamentally racist. You're calling most people in the UK racist. Strong claims should have strong evidence. But to even ask for that evidence is racist. So these kind of accusations with no evidence, there's another story that just shows the real life consequences of that. And this was a report published to authorities in Manchester, where you had around 100 people, 100 men abusing, they call it grooming. A lot of times it's basically it's raping and prostituting teenage girls, young girls, and they attacked about 60 girls in Manchester in the early 2000s. And this report was into how the police at the highest level covered it up. And the reason why they covered it up is that most of the perpetrators were of a different race. The reports tend to talk about Asian. I mean, that in itself is a bit of a euphemism. They're all Pakistani background Muslim men. that are abusing these girls. And the police did not want to step in and protect these girls and stop this crime because they were afraid of accusations of racism. You know, they had the addresses of where these men lived. They knew where these crimes were going on. In one instance, there was a girl who was in social care. She was being looked after by the government, by the authorities. They've got all of the documents, all of the records from her care home that show the authorities knew she was being raped. They knew she was being assaulted. They knew she was being prostituted out by these men. They didn't do anything. She was taken to the home of a 50-year-old man, injected with heroin, and later died. And this report talks about how, one of the quotes from a detective in the report, he said, "What had a massive input was that the offending target group were predominantly Asian males, and we were told to try and get other ethnicities." It said that the police were aware of sensitive community issues. It says concerns were expressed about the risk of, of incitement of racial hatred. So basically, you know, they knew if we go in and solve this, it's going to look bad on our stats. You know, it's going to come out and it's going to show that the Lanchester police arrested an overwhelmingly disproportionate number of Pakistani men for sexual assaults. And they knew, well, we're going to be accused of racism if we do that. They'll say, well, why are you arresting such a disproportionate number of people from one ethnic group? Well, that must be racist. Mm-hmm. And so they stepped back from doing that. And this isn't the only time that it happened. Rotherham was a huge one where there were 1,400 identified victims. And again, others remembered clear direction from their manager not to do so, not to talk about what was happening, not to identify the ethnic background because of this accusation. So when you see these people on TV making these baseless accusations of racism, you know, this is the real world consequences of saying that. You know, you have these people where they're investigating a crime. Most of these people committing a crime come from a certain background. They step back from addressing that because they're right. You know, it shouldn't have stopped them, but Manchester police are probably right. If they had gone along and prosecuted that crime the way that they should have, they would have been accused of being racist. But here they stopped, and it's because of those people that we've seen on TV this week that these kind of problems happen.
It's such a stunning example of the perverse nature of this new morality, the leftist morality, who they're looking at these manufactured crimes like racism toward a woman who's pretty much white, and they're saying that this is one of the worst crimes that Britain could commit, and meanwhile they really will overlook actual atrocities that are just, I mean, it's just horrifying to even contemplate. And it's remarkable how willing they are to look the other way towards something like that. I mean, just judging by the absolute standard of biblical morality, these are in absolutely separate worlds. But the difference between a manufactured crime and a sin, an egregious sin, an abominable sin, couldn't be more clear if you're looking at it through the right lens. Now, you wrote about the Rotherham crimes that took place. This was some years ago in the Trumpet print edition, I think 2014. Maybe you could just talk mm-hmm. about that and direct our listeners for more information.
Yeah, I mean, the Rotherham, like, I think we covered a lot of the details. This was one of the reports said, one of the locals for Rotherham said, well, gang rape here is just a normal part of growing up. It was shocking just how common this was. But one of the other things that we talked about in that article is, you know, this is what God specifically in the Bible condemns our nations for, this kind of immorality. This is one of the things that he draws attention to. There are specific scriptures that talk about exactly the kind of thing that we see going on. You know, this is why we have a whole lot of the other news stories that we talk about, because society has a massive sickness and we need correction. And God is raising up some of these other powers in the world and arranging these other things in world events to correct us. For example, you have, Isaiah chapter 1, a scripture that we come back to a lot, talks about the whole head is sick. From the sole of the foot even unto the head, there is no soundness in it. You've got a sick society at all levels. One of the other scriptures things that Isaiah chapter 1 talks about, where it's going through all the different sins of our nation, it says while your princes are rebellious, this is from the New King James, and the Companion of Feith, everyone loves bribes and follows after rewards. They do not defend the fatherless. And this, you know, the fatherless, this is a huge trend in what we see. A lot of them, they would prey on girls without that were in care, that had no parents, or ones that didn't have a father figure, and nobody protected them. For Rotherham, it was about a third, I think, of the girls that they preyed on were in the social care system. Like you said, we're much more concerned about virtue signaling, about as a society, about showing off how moral we are, how aware of whatever the big trend is and looking good on Twitter, than we are about actually protecting the fatherless, about stopping these egregious crimes. You know, we live in a society that tolerates this kind of thing, while it will go crazy about Meghan Markle and the supposed racism there. And, you know, this is just one symptom. It's a really disgusting symptom, but it's one of a whole load of symptoms of a major, major sickness right at the heart of our society. That article that I wrote on the Rotherham was called on what went on in Rotherham. That was called Hope for the Child Victims of Rotherham. And then we also have an article up on our website that just talks in more detail about exactly what went on in Manchester in that latest report. That's a report British police told to ignore Pakistani rape gangs. It's one disgusting symptom of some huge problems in British society.
Thank you for bringing that to us, Richard. Very disturbing and sickening. And I think that putting those two stories together, what the kerfuffle over this supposed racism toward Meghan Markle and what's happening there in Britain in those gangs, is instructive. We do appreciate you bringing that to us, and we'll put links to those articles in the show notes for the program. End Time Bible Prophecy prominently features a spectacular clash between Europe and Iran. Yet for as provocative as Iran has been for some years now, it's remarkable how restrained Europe has been. But this week, Europe did take a small step toward a harder stance against the Islamic Republic. For this story, we'll turn to Warren Reinsch.
Yeah, this week was Europe's first step in holding Iran accountable for its nuclear belligerence. This week, Britain, France, and Germany triggered what is called the Iran Nuclear Dispute Mechanism. It's basically an idea where if one party isn't upholding its obligations in the nuclear deal, then someone can bring this dispute through a different series of commissions, like the Joint Commission, an advisory board, the Security Council, and the idea is to find a solution to the dispute. So they released this in a joint statement. This was Britain, France, and Germany. They said, quote, "We have therefore been left with no choice given Iran's actions but to register today our concerns that Iran is not meeting its commitments under the JCPOA and to refer this matter to the Joint Commission." This is really the first step we've seen where Europe has come out publicly and really acknowledged what Iran is doing. This comes just about a week after Iran announced that it was no longer going to abide by the restrictions of the nuclear deal. We know it's pretty public knowledge that they've been breaking these, but for once they actually came out and said that, you know, the whole thing is gone. They're not going to abide by these restrictions. According to the JCPOA, the whole process could take about 65 days. It could be a little bit longer, but by the end of the process, it has to go through so many different levels. It's very hard to actually come up with a resolution. So it'd be very likely that it would just go through all of these different levels, and then in the end, it would just it would reimpose sanctions from before the JCPOA.
Yeah, isn't it interesting hearing Europe going through all of this rigmarole after what the United States just did to Qasem Soleimani? No negotiations, no committees, just got something done. And it's remarkable just how quiet Iran has been for the most part since that time. You'd have to think that there would be European leaders. I mean, you can look at this in one sense and say, well, hey, they're standing up and they're saying, well, Iran isn't abiding by the terms of this agreement that we made. But at the same time, you have to think there are European leaders who saw what Donald Trump did and are taking notes. You just wonder how much Donald Trump's actions have emboldened a certain segment, at least, of European leadership. As much as they want to criticize him and say, you know, that this he's acting recklessly and he's leading us toward war and so on. I don't think there's anybody who isn't applauding the fact that this did put Iran in its place.
Yeah, and I think this is especially significant when you think about it in terms of Bible prophecy. The Bible talks about the main aggressor, the main conflict being between Iran and Europe. Right now, obviously, we know it's been going on in the last couple weeks between the United States and Iran. But the Bible says that it's going to be Europe, and it doesn't mention the United States whatsoever. So when you think about that, it is really interesting to see this this statement come out from Europe. Obviously, something big is going to happen in the future for this huge war, this huge conflict to break out. But it is really interesting to see this happening. The Iranian president, Hassan Rouhani, came out and he made this pretty strong statement. And it was really interesting when you think about that Bible prophecy. He said this, quote, "Today, the American soldier is in danger. Tomorrow, the European soldier could be in danger. We want you, Europe, to leave this region," end quote. So mm-hmm. It's a very clear statement from the Iranian president, and you can see that they're not really looking at the United States. I don't think they're super concerned at the moment about the United States, but they're really looking at Europe, and they've been trying to work with Europe to get sanctions relief from the United States, and that hasn't been working out for them. I think now that they're starting to push more against Europe, they're starting to try and get break free from the economic sanctions that they're under.
And it really does show just what a disaster that nuclear deal was all along. I mean, the fact is that Iran has been on this path toward nuclear weaponization all along. The fact that European leaders are acknowledging that to some degree, it does point you to that prophecy that you're talking about in Daniel 11 verses 40 and 41. But you look at the difference between, say, them triggering a dispute mechanism right now, which is almost a, I mean, it's really nothing in the scope of things. And meanwhile, Daniel prophesies at the time when they're actually going to come against the king of the south, the Iranian-led Islamic force, like a whirlwind with many ships, and they're just going to wipe out whole nations. You know that we're going to see some fireworks ahead in that relationship between the two before that prophecy is fulfilled. We'll put a link to Gerald Fleury's article about the nuclear deal, the worst foreign policy blunder in American history. It's interesting to look back on that in light of what's been happening recently, and then knowing that prophecy, exactly how this is going to unfold will be very interesting to watch. We do appreciate you bringing that to us, Warren. You're listening to Trumpet Hour. Coming up, we'll hear an expose on the truly radical wing within the staff of the Democratic presidential frontrunner. We'll also talk about Germany in Libya and China in Myanmar and more. We'll be right back.
This is the voice of the Trumpet News Magazine. You're listening to Trumpet Hour.
The Democrat Party in America has shifted notably to the left in recent years, even just since the last presidential election. And it's stunning how even the presidential candidates who are considered centrist are pushing extremely radical proposals. But the ones on the left of the party are really extreme left. And this week, an undercover investigation revealed a full-time member of the staff of one of the Democrat frontrunners who is as radical as you can imagine. For this story, we'll turn to Andrew Miller.
Yeah, well, Project Veritas has struck again with secretly recording several conversations from an Iowa campaign staff organizer working for presidential candidate Bernie Sanders. And they are as radical as you could ever imagine. It's hard to get good quotes from him because they're so profanity laced. Mm-hmm. But in one of the conversations, he was predicting that cities are going to burn if President Trump wins re-election. Here's actually one of the quotes you're able to extract out of his this video footage. He says, "The only thing that fascists understand is violence. So the only way you can confront them is with violence." And when he said fascist. He's deliberately putting that in the context of those who voted for President Donald Trump.
Right.
And saying so the only thing they understand is violence. And so if he wins the next election, you need to fight them with violence. He even turned his wrath against what he considers as the moderate wing of the Democratic Party, like the executives at MSNBC, who some would say are not part of the moderate wing of the Democratic Party. But to him, the MSNBC reporting is moderate. And so he told one of the undercover investigators, he said, "I'm ready to throw down, walk into NBC studios, drag out people by their hair and light them on fire in the streets. I'll tell you what they did in Cuba, what they did to reactionaries. You want to fight against the revolution, you're going to die." First, he's predicting cities burned with fire to stop the Republicans. Second, we're lighting liberal Democrats on fire because they're fighting against the revolution. And then in a third conversation, he's actually even defending Stalin's gulags and saying that we need to re-educate Trump supporters in similar camps. He made a point about, hey, well, the Germany had to spend billions of dollars re-educating the Nazis. America's going to have to do the same thing to Trump supporters, re-educating them after, his Bernie Sanders movement wins election. Staying, they said there's a reason Joseph Stalin had gulags. Actually, gulags were a lot better than what the CIA's told us. People were paid a living wage, had conjugal visits. They're actually meant for re-education. There's a bunch of other things he said, but these are amongst the most radical and shockingly, or maybe not so shockingly, at least latest I've heard, he hasn't been fired for any of this. Mm-hmm. And neither Bernie Sanders nor anyone else in his campaign has condemned him for any of this. I think the only thing that's happened is pretty much all Sanders supporters have locked their Twitter accounts just to help conceal the fact that there may be more there may be more people with this guy's type opinions in the Sanders campaign. But obviously those who've listened to this program for a good period of time know that one of the key prophecies we really come back to is Isaiah 1 and verse 7, that where the prophet Isaiah is saying that it's like cities will burn with fire, strangers will devour it within your midst. And it's in the context of like civil war and race rioting and urban rioting in the United States of America, painting a picture very similar to what this Sanders campaign staffer has described. And when you look at this ideological divide between probably the majority of the American people and then this growing radical left movement, you could really start to see how a prophecy like that could be fulfilled here in the end time.
Is there anywhere that you would send people for more understanding of the prophetic implications here?
Waiting for that feature article in the next print edition is a good place to go. But until then, we can put up a reprint article we have called Communism in America Today. That's from our editor-in-chief, Mr. Gerald Fleury.
All right. Thank you very much for that, Andrew. Libya has been a chaotic mess ever since Muammar Gaddafi was killed by extremists in 2011. And it's a problem that makes Europe very uncomfortable, being right across the Mediterranean from the continent. Germany is trying to step up and find a solution. For this story, we'll go back to Richard Palmer.
Yes, Germany has organized a big peace conference for Libya that will take place in Berlin over the weekend. They've already organized a ceasefire between the two major sides. They've done that by working with Russia and by working with Turkey, the German Chancellor Angela Merkel. She recently took a trip to Russia, something she's not done in a while, and it seemed like she was getting the ground ready for this peace process by doing that. And we talked about the German-Russian relationship and Turkey as well on last week's show. So I want to instead focus on what is going on in Libya and in the Middle East, because this German push to get more involved in Libya is something that Trumpet editor-in-chief Gerald Fleury has really focused on. One of the articles that I still regret not putting on that top 10 list articles from the last decade from our editor-in-chief is one called Mediterranean Battle Escalating into World War III. I really should have found a way to make that on there. It is a landmark article. But in there, he talks about Germany's ambitions in Libya. And this is something that they've had a long-standing they've been probably the most significant European player in pushing for some kind of peaceful resolution in Libya, pushing for a peace process, pushing for a peace conference. Now they've got one. They're all going to be sitting down, and it wouldn't surprise me if this time next week we're talking about the results of that. But this German push into Libya is critical to watch. In that article, Mr. Flurry talks about that part of the reason Germany lost World War II is that they didn't control the Mediterranean. And he talked about how a German-led Europe has been working to make sure that it doesn't make the same mistake again. He talked about German pushes to have a peace process over there. And he asked, will we begin to see Europeans once again land on the shores of Libya? And he said the European Union and its Western allies have created a situation where German troops will once again set foot in Libya. So he was saying that this crisis is probably going to end with some kind of German peacekeeping force. He talked about what he said, providing the perfect cover for German ambition. The European peacekeeping force will help Germany move closer to realizing Rommel's goal of complete dominance in the Mediterranean. He talked about how this will set up the Titanic clash talked about in Daniel 11 and verse 40. And he talked about how that clash won't just end with Libya. It will draw in a whole load of other countries as well. And so he said, watch the Mediterranean. Bible prophecy says it will be a major staging ground for battles that will escalate into world war. And I think with Germany organizing this peace conference, you see potentially a major shift in this, with Germany perhaps getting ready to play a much more active role in Libya. There's a lot of German generals and senior German military staff that have talked about this for a long, long time. You know, they have a major operation in Mali. They've talked about Mali as a staging ground for a potential operation in Libya. And so they're really, with this peace conference and the fact that they, along with Turkey and Russia, have helped organize a ceasefire that's lasted the last week. We could be about to see, we're definitely seeing a stepped up German diplomatic engagement in this area. And that could well lead to a stepped up German military engagement in that area as well.
All right. Thank you very much, Richard. China's president is visiting the Southeast Asian country of Myanmar today. To learn about the implications of this visit, we'll go back to Jeremiah Jacques.
Yes, the flags of China and Myanmar are fluttering side by side today along the roads in Myanmar's capital, because China's president is visiting there. This is his first time visiting Myanmar since he's been China's leader. He did go there once before in 2009 when he was vice president, but now he is there as the paramount leader of China, and he's there with one very clearly outlined goal. And that is to unstall projects that China and Myanmar are building together under the framework of China's Belt and Road Initiative. That's China's plan to kind of eventually be able to dominate the world economy by building all kinds of ports and roads and rails and networks of all kinds and pipelines across Asia and Europe and the Middle East and Africa. And Myanmar's location makes it a really important nation for the Belt and Road Initiative. There are numerous projects that fall under the umbrella of the China-Myanmar Economic Corridor, and then there's also the Kiak-Fayu Special Economic Zone, which is what China hopes to make into its kind of a strategic backdoor to the Indian Ocean. And it looks like Xi will be able to get these projects unfrozen and just make some major strides for the Belt and Road.
So why would China be so interested in Myanmar?
Well, one of China's greatest fears is a maritime blockade of its coast. China's economy is deeply dependent on both imports and exports, so a naval blockade there would really pose an existential threat to it. It wouldn't be able to bring in all the oil and gas that it needs from the Middle East or export its finished goods to Europe and the rest of the world. But with Myanmar, there would be an alternative route. I mentioned that Kiak-Fayu Special Economic Zone, that's really the number one project that Xi Jinping's trying to revitalize, and it would ultimately be a full-scale operation operational deep sea port right there in the Indian Ocean. So it would function as a backdoor for China. Even if the U.S. or some of the Quad nations were to blockade the Straits of Malacca or other parts of China's coast there, China would still have this port open so it could bypass the South China Sea entirely and still be able to import and export through there. So that's something of massive value to China, to have kind of a backdoor, an alternate route. And in the context of Bible prophecy, this is all deeply significant because Isaiah 23 talks about a trade block that would form in the end time that would include China as one of its main powers and Europe also as one of its main powers. So China and Europe are linked together in these ancient prophecies, and now the Belt and Road projects are physically and economically linking them more deeply together today. So it's remarkable to see this prophecy moving toward fulfillment. And for listeners who would like to better understand that, we have an article called Brave New World Made in China that goes through those prophecies and just explains the significance of the Belt and Road Initiative in that prophetic context.
Well, thank you, Jeremiah. One last story here. Israel recently announced further advancements in its impressive missile defenses. For this, we'll go back to Warren Reinsch.
Yeah, on January 8th, Israel's defense ministry announced that it made a technological breakthrough in the ability to use lasers to intercept rockets. This is a really large development. It's been working at this for about 10 years. Finally, it's got this huge breakthrough. They are intending to put this even on tanks, so it wouldn't just be for missile interception. They could put it on their tanks to intercept incoming anti-tank rockets, which is very incredible to think about this technology. They're going to put it on drones as well. So they're really trying to implement this in as many different aspects of the military as they can. The thing is, it is very expensive. If you think about the Iron Dome, it's another missile system or anti-rocket system. The Iron Dome has a very high upfront cost, but it also has a high intercept cost, which means it's about $100 million for each of the 10 batteries that it has. But each missile that it intercepts is about $50,000. Mm. So the difference is, with this laser system, it's got a high upfront cost, but each intercept is only a few cents because all it uses is electricity. So in the long run, this is a very good development for Israel. Obviously, as I mentioned, it's part of the anti-rocket system. Israel is attacked by rockets all the time. So this would hopefully shore up some of its defenses. The Iron Dome is great. It does a really good job, but it struggles in certain areas, hitting smaller targets like drones, like these anti-tank rockets. And that's where the laser system is going to do a lot better. And it is accurate. It's been tested. And if it's if it goes through more testing this year, it's anticipated to be put implemented in the Gaza border region. But the interesting thing is we pointed to this for years. Back in 1999, Mr. Fleury wrote an article entitled America's Achilles Heel. And he was just showing how computer technology has certain weaknesses. No computer is invulnerable. And that is one of the weaknesses of this system. The Prime Minister Netanyahu even mentioned last year at the CyberTech conference that Israel is dramatically vulnerable to cyber attacks. So while this missile interception technology has made Israel virtually invulnerable to enemy missiles, it is also creating at the same time its greatest vulnerability.
Very interesting. Warren has an article up on the website, Iron Beam, Israel's new missile intercepting laser technology, that puts this in greater prophetic context, goes into greater depth on the point that he made there at the end of his report. We thank you very much for that, Warren. I'm Joel Hilliker. That's it for today's Trumpet Hour. You can email us your thoughts on the program to letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks to our panel, Jeremiah Jacques, Andrew Miller, Warren Reinsch, and Richard Palmer. Thanks to Jeremiah for engineering and production. I'll leave you with the words of Pierre Corneille: when there is no peril in the fight, there is no glory in the triumph. Thanks for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.
You've been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.